I think I can wind it up in about a half hour. I want to stop with the 12th step, which is gratitude, and I'll explain what gratitude is. Before I do that, I want to talk about the psychological drive to drink, or called the face of the enemy. Now, this is a fantastic lecture which has taken me umpteen years to put together, and actually I stole it from a Dr. Russell Smith. And it's usually done on a blackboard, and I use all kinds of colored chalk and everything. But we've got to be aware of what we're up against. Okay? And so when I talk about the psychological drive to drink, again, you've got to accept the anatomy of the brain and what happens in the brain. And in the brain, there is the hypothalamus gland, which is real as this table. And that's a very simple gland that tells us things like, when you're freezing to death, like we were last week, get in out of the cold. And if you're on the railroad track and the train is coming along, I am getting punchy, right? Get off the railroad track. When you're hungry, eat. I don't do that, but okay. And you know, when you're tired, lie down. So I talk about the phases of drinking or the phases of addiction. I'm not talking, about just alcoholism. That will get into it. But I want to start looking at what goes on in your brain. So you might be sober 3 weeks, or you might be sober 35 years. It doesn't make any difference. This is what you're up against. When the brain, first of all, sees a drink, bing. It goes back through the conscious part of your brain. This is where you make decisions. Yes, I will drink. No, I will not drink. And that's what you have to have continuing conditioning therapy for. When it does that, it goes back into the hypothalamus gland. The hypothalamus gland goes over, it shoots it over to the pleasure pain center, and it goes up into the memory looking at the pleasure pain. We're talking about the experimental stage of drinking. That's when we first picked up a drink. And what type of reaction does that get out of our brain? It goes back into the memory cortex of your brain, and if that memory cortex had to be put on film, microfilm, it would be something like 5 miles long, right? Everything's in there. We forget a lot of things on purpose and a lot of things not on purpose. But what it does, when the experimental stage is when we first got into drinking. And it could have been, I'm just going to use rough examples, you can fill in your own, but say we're 16 years old, and it's the homecoming game for the football team, and we go to the football game, and we get our older brother or one of the older guys to get us a six-pack or a case of beer, and we go under the baseball stand, and we light up a few cigarettes like the big people do, the old people do, and we have a couple of pints of Mother Molson's Pure All, and boom! Nice, warm, bubbly feeling in the tummy, and we know we're putting something over on our parents or the old people or the teachers or the institution, and it's very, very exciting. And it gets filed away as something worthy of being repeated. In the deep, I've already told you about Kent Tavern sitting there with all of the hockey players, right? And we can all go back, you know, to those type of instances. I'm giving you the ones the guys use, you know, or great athletic prowess. And so then what did drinking mean to us then? It meant euphoria. It meant freedom from everything. It meant passage from adolescence into adulthood. For the girls, it's always, you know, the belle of the ball, you know, the most beautiful person at the ball, the best dancer, the most glamorous, and all of those things. And we get back to imagining those things. That's what the memory starts picking up. does that get positive or negative reinforcement? It gets negative, it gets very positive reinforcement. Alright? And so, we continue to say, yep, that's good. And what it's reaching for in the memory are the good things. The next phase of drinking then is, you know, the social phase. I'm not talking about social drinking, I'm just talking about a phase that goes on, it's called social phase, and that's when tolerance came in to play. Tolerance, the medical word, meaning it takes more of the agent to arrive at the same state of euphoria. In other words, we used to drink two drinks and feel pretty good, and the next time we go out and do two drinks, boom, nothing's happening. And somebody says, have another drink. Boom, we have another drink, bam, lights go on, the nice warm bubbly feeling in the tummy and the ears wiggle and the nose turns red and the eyes go around and we're there. And we're dancing like Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire and we are doing everything. And it's magnificent. We are better athletes, we are better creatures, we are better everything. We are better, you know, and there's nothing in life that doesn't involve that if we are so inclined to do that. From baptisms to wakes, alcohol gets involved. Imagine when you went to a party when you were drinking and they said, we do not serve alcohol here. Splitsville, right? I mean, even after I was ordained in the throes of my alcoholism, I would go to a place and they'd say, well, we understand the Catholic priests don't drink. And so you want Coca-Cola or coffee? I'm saying, well, Mrs. Jones, I just came to say how grateful I am you invited to this party, but Mrs. Brown's in the hospital and she's dying and I must get there right now. There's nobody in the hospital. But we're not going to stay around because it is boring, right? I mean, if we've got a drink in our hand, we'll subject ourselves to all kinds of pain, people coming up and talking to us, all kinds of gibberish. But as long as two, we know where another drink is coming from, right? And we're at a wedding, we always have that sixth sense, you know where the guy with the tray is, right? And you know he's over there now, and he's going to be going that way, so we'll just saunter on down. Oh, you again, what do you know? Boom. And everything we do in life, you know, you're going to have an office party, you know for sure what's an office party mean, a birthday party, a baptism celebration. And if you're Irish, awake, right? Because Irish is, Ireland, there's a pub in every third house, right? And how they celebrate everything is, you know, let's have a drink. They drink hard liquor early in the morning. I mean, this is all types of celebrations. So what I'm saying, when that phase goes on, you start drinking, and you know, when I'm talking social phase, things get better. You can do things better, even, it is true that your dexterity does pick up. I'm talking about alcoholics now, all right? And I know way back in 68 or 9 or 70, the movie came out of Canada called .08, which was the movie which they put the pylons down in the parking lot and let the drivers drive through them perfectly, right? And they give them one drink, two drinks, three drinks, and by the end of the day, they're knocking over every pylon in the world, right? And so they're saying, see, if you drink, you drive very poorly. But they don't know the guy that I know that they threw out of the movie because the more he drank, the better he drove. Right? And again, at a plateau, there's a guy waving at me. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. The initial stages then because, and we attribute this to ourselves that we're really mature and proud, and we don't know it. It's the liver. It's the liver being able to oxidize alcohol down to acetaldehyde, acetic acid, carbon dioxide in water much faster. You know, the ordinary 80% of the people over here will, you know, it's 3/4 of an ounce to 1 ounce an hour. You put 9 drinks in them, let them go to bed for 7 hours, they wake up, there's still 2 ounces of unoxidized alcohol in their system. That's what makes their tummy feel like there's 1,000 Arabs running around in there without their toenails cut to 79. That the train has just run over their tongue and that their head's 9 feet across and they're saying, I'll never drink again. Talk to one of us who takes 9 drinks in one night at the early stages of our drinking and then we go to our normal place of repose for 3 hours. Top of the diving board, under the Christmas tree, upstairs at Louis' bar, back seat of the car, in the garage, only for 3 hours. Because this person is burning off alcohol three quarters of an ounce to once an hour. Over here, it's at least 4 ounces an hour. So if he goes, lies down, or leans against the lamppost for 3 hours, boom, it's gone. And he wakes up the next morning saying, I thought we were going to go play tennis. Everybody's going, oh, Lord, don't make so much noise. In other words, there is no ill effect at the beginning. And so as we go through then, everything that we do in life involves alcohol. I mean, I can remember going to see the Alouettes play, and I had more booze on me to get all of Section W loaded. I mean, there was alcohol in the binocular case. There was alcohol in the camera case. There was alcohol in the cushion. And it's all hot toddy, because you got to stay warm at football games. And we drunks know that alcohol warms you up. It really doesn't. It lowers body temperature. But we will believe that it warms us up. So you got all these hot toddies, but what you don't realize is it's the 15th of August and it's 82 degrees out. Right? Doesn't make any difference. You know? Why do we go to football games? To drink. All the world was saved, you know, to drink. Why do we go to parties? To be with people and to associate with them and to find out how they're, whoa, Rooney. We go to drink. And as long as we got the drink in our hand, fine. We can tolerate and listen to all their stories about their kids and everything else that goes on. And if you're a priest, they always want to talk religion. It is just the boringest thing. But as long as you drink, you know, it's about 5 drinks. Let me tell you about God, Father. Just so I see it, you know. Oh, it's you know, I can get tape recordings of. So we go through that stage. What type of reinforcement does it get from the brain? Positive or negative? Positive. How many? Maybe a 500. Incidents. How many of us flew on airplanes? And they gave us those disgusting little, you know, misuse of alcohol bottles like this. I mean, that's an insult to our profession, right? And we drank them, and did anything happen? Of course not. How could anything happen? That's an insult to where most of us carried something else, too, you know, our own. Golf. That means what's the first thing we're going to do? Okay, we get through that. So in the brain, there's nothing but positive reinforcement that worked and that was good. The next stage is the stage which gives us courage. In other words, we have to go to the dentist. Dutch courage is called kind of the mystical stage. Okay, we're going to go to the dentist. We hate the dentist. It's pain dentist. But so we need a little Dutch courage. So you drop into the local gin mill or Louis watering hole and you have 3 ounces of tiger sweat. And then you come out there and you can go into the dentist because we're trained that way. Every time you went to a movie, you saw John Wayne walk into the bar, go out and beat up everybody who was bad, right? And so we're going to go to the dentist now. We're caught in some type of fear. And so what do? Boom. White's on you to get a raise. You've been working for the Acme Ice Company for 46 years. You have not been late one day in your life. You have put in 40 hours every week and you've never missed a day of sickness or anything else. And she says, you've been working for 46 years and you haven't had a raise yet. Go and ask the boss for a raise. Well, okay, I will. So what do? Have a couple of good more shots of good old tiger sweat, right? Get our courage up, walk in, and say, boss, I want a raise. And he says, well, I'll check the record. And he checks, 46 years, haven't been raised. Okay, you got the raise. We walk out. Who gets the credit for the raise? Good old John Barleycorn. And does it work? Yes. When we have to give speeches in public or when we're embarrassed or something else like that, or we have to go dancing. Now, how many of us dance cold sober? Right? Not in your life. You know, because part of the training which I do with people is to get them doing things which they used to do and now you have to learn to do them without drinking. And that really became very hilarious, you know. I mean, we think that you know, just, well, I can remember going to baseball games with people who had never been inside of Tiger Stadium without drinking for 20 years, and now they go for the first time without anything to drink. It's just like taking a fish out of the water or out of the tank. They're totally jittery and lost and everything. Okay, so that stage worked very well, too. Then we get into the conflicting stages of we're using alcohol for conflicting reasons. This is called the hopeful stage. We use alcohol at football games to warm us up, and we use alcohol at baseball games to cool us off. Does it work? Yes. We use alcohol at baptisms to celebrate life. We use alcohol at wakes to celebrate death. Does it work? Yes. We use alcohol in the daytime to pick us up. And what do? The last thing at night before we go to bed? Have a drink, have a nightcap, right? All conflicting reasons. Does it make sense? No. Does it work? Yes. And so what is the messages that are coming out of the brain? Yes, it works. And then we get into the hopeful, we get into the medicinal stage. The medicinal stage is we're getting progressing quite serious now in our addiction, but what the medicinal stage is, we use the very agent that's killing us to get us well. A little bit of the hair of the dog that bit you the night before is all you need, and you'll be fine. So we wake up and we don't feel too good. What's the first thing we do? Have a drink. I grew up in a society that said, open a pint of Mother Molson's Cure-All before you go to bed and stick it on the bed table, right? And when you get up the next morning and don't feel good, just drink it and you'll feel fine. Does it work? Yes. Because what it does is it expands the blood vessels, pushes all the alcohol that was stored in body fat depots back into the blood vessels, and you're high all over again and you just think it's great, right? Okay. And so does that get positive reinforcement? Yes. And so we're able to do that. You know, when people say, I'm shaking so bad, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink. Right? Boom. And then I'm just, you don't always have to be in full-blown delirium tremens or anything like that. It just can be irritability, sleep patterns, or whatever. And then the last stage we get, now does that get positive reinforcement? Does it work? Yes. You know, when we're sick from drinking too much and we start drinking again the next day, to clear the cobwebs out of our brain and everything, does it work? Yes. Does that get reinforcement from the brain? Yes. How many? Maybe another 500 times. The last stage that we talk about is the hopeless stage. And that is where there is no more free decision to make. That is where it's not a matter of will I drink or will I not drink. It's a matter of I've got to drink. And the only way I can stay alive is the drinking, because if I stop drinking, I gotta face free floating anxiety, and I gotta face withdrawal. And that is very frightening. And so when that gets in there, there's no more free choice. Is there any positive reinforcement from the brain coming out of the memory on that one? No. But what happens now, you've got all of these 500s put together, maybe 5 times, all giving you the positive reasons to drink. Now you go to AA, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people in the AA group. And you sit at the table, and no matter what they are talking about, they can be talking about flight patterns in World War II with the Royal Canadian Air Force, they can be talking about football, hockey, baseball, whatever, or hopefully they can be talking about the steps. You can go home from that meeting steaming mad, saying, that's the craziest meeting I ever want. I'll never want to go to that. That's active participation. The subliminal message that's going on is, Vaughn, that's me, you cannot drink. The message is coming 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And so what's happening is there's 9 check marks which go back up into the memory cortex of the brain that are saying that. Okay? Then we go to an open meeting and the person gives a talk and we get 1 check mark. And what we're talking about is building up the resistance, you know, that so that when all of this stuff, if it ever comes out, what it does is you keep putting the check marks in and it blocks or builds a wall from the memory cortex into the forward conscious part of the brain. So the business of, well, it's 90 degrees out and I've lost a lot of salt today and I really have a salt deficiency and right now for medicinal purposes, I think maybe I should just have 1 beer. That never gets into the forward conscious part of the brain. But stop going to meetings, stop putting those check marks in there, dissolve those away in time, and you have a tiger in your tank that's going to come out and get right into the forward conscious part of your brain, and then you're going to rationalize. And a rationalization is an argument you have with yourself till you're losing time. You're up against the most cunning, baffling, insidious, powerful, you know, because you're talking about your brain and what's coming out of your brain. And so, you know, that's why if I make a couple of inferences of people who stay sober for long periods of time, but graduate after 30 years or whatever. Right? And what happens is, Father, I don't know what happened. You know, I was in for 36 years, and bingo. And it's perfectly understandable, and we've got to know that it's not a matter of having power over that, but the minute we stop going to meetings, be it AA, same for the Al-Anon, the same type of behavior will come out, right? Then it'll go from positive to negative. If we don't put those check marks in there, all of those messages rush up to the forward conscious part of the brain, and we start to, well, maybe. Once we start that, we're going to dissolve away all of the check marks, and if we don't reinforce them, we're dead. And when you're dead, you're dead. It's as simple as that. Because a lot of people say, I don't understand, and even professionals will say, you know, and all kinds of therapists, and you know, and that helps. I'm not against that at all. At all. Anything that helps is good. But the basic thing is, it's not an intellectual assent to what I'm talking about. It's commitment. And it's commitment to doing things. And even I say when you go home, roaring mad about the meeting, you're still getting the subliminal message in your gut that'll get into the unconscious, bond, you can't drink. And what staying sober is all about is building up enough check marks so that whenever we start waffling on it, that business in the forward conscious about, yeah, I think I can take one now, certainly can't help hurt me now, after all these years, gets dissolved away completely. It doesn't even get in there because it's walled off from the memory to the forward conscious part of the brain. In between those two sections of your brain is the coordination section, motor coordination, which skips right over that, gets into the forward conscious part of your brain. And that's when you start, you know. And what you're looking for, and the only thing that's going to come out are the good things. Believe me, the only things that are going to come out are all the reasons why you should. It does not go, the hypothalamus does not go back in there looking for negative things. Does not go back looking for the shame and the guilt and the pain and the remorse and all of the horrible things that we went through and the pain we suffered and all. No, that's all gone. And all comes out is euphoria. Let's go back and try to live some of that euphoria over again. And what happens is that we're X number of years older and don't respond half as well as we did then, and the results are always catastrophic in a negative way. And that is the face of the enemy. That's the psychological drive to drink. It's not a matter of, because I have so many people coming to me saying, I think I know what was wrong. Right? I think I know what I got to do. I think, you know, I find the meetings boring, or I find, hey, it's medicine. Who in the world thinks that everything should be total exhilaration just for you at all times? You know, the world, the sun does not rise and set for me. We used to think that it should. Let me finish with gratitude. And this is what the 12th step is. What is gratitude? It is not sitting around saying, oh, how happy I am that God gave me the program. I'm a happy recovering alcoholic. And this is really exciting. Gratitude, listen now, this comes from Hanselier Experimental Surgery. I spent months up there. Right, the doctor who, you know, in the University of Montreal, who studied why people get sick. Right? Like 60% of the people or more that are in hospitals are not sick at all. Right? It's some goofy thing, psychosomatic, that they think they're sick. Right? Okay. What gratitude is the amount of blood, sweat, tears, energy that I am willing to expend to instill in other people a desire that I am going to succeed because of the things that I am doing. Action is the magic word. Right? So, if I'm, you know, before we came into AA, our life was total narcissism. Totally turned in on self. It was me, 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 look after number one, the heck with everybody else, I want what I want when I want it, and da 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 da. And, you know, we were totally incapable of loving anyone. And that doesn't come easy, because I've had tons of alkies crying to me, I love my kids, though. Incapable. Right? Really, of extending ourselves for the spiritual growth of another person it's incapable. Okay, and then what gratitude is, now we're in the program, and what we have to start learning to do is live in a way that's going to be able to express that for other people and to accept their love and care back, which can be just as hard. In other words, we're no longer in it for ourselves. You know, and we get into the spiritual life. The spiritual life is a life of sharing. And if we don't give it away and share, then we're going to lose it. But gratitude is, what am I willing to do? You know, how am I willing to extend myself, you know, spend energy, do things so that, you know, gets instilled that I'm going to succeed. In other words, before we came in the program, be it AA or Al-Anon, what we were really saying to people is, get out of my face. Really? You know, I can do it my way. You know, Billy Blue Eyes song, there, Sinatra, My Way. You know, I've heard that thing sung at AA meetings, I almost died, right? I really did. You know, because that's here, total egoism, right? And that's what we have to deflate. And so when we talk about, okay, how did I learn this? Austin Ripley was not a priest. He was the founder of Guest House, where actually I ended up in doing the positive part of my therapy. And he says to me, Father, this is after a year, right? Are you grateful for all the things that have happened to you? Are you grateful that you were canned out of the priesthood at less than 1 year ordained and suspended for a time where you are no longer able to function in, which means removal of faculties, you weren't able to celebrate Eucharist, administer sacraments or whatever. Are you grateful for the fact that you were deported out of your country and you were placed in a secure environment, namely Our Lady of Mercy Nut House, dressed in your funny little honeymoon suit where you pursued such high intellectual pursuits as weaving baskets, making wallets, playing in porno, buddy? Are you grateful for the fact that all of those things happened to you and that if they did not happen to you, you would have lost your priesthood before you were 35 or 33 and you would have been dead by your 35? Now I am talking, or the man is talking to me who holds the ticket for my return to Canada. Right? This is boss. This is God. Right? And so naturally, oh, Mr. Ripley, you don't know how grateful I am. I mean that Jesus would bring me to this hallowed halls of rehabilitation and I would be given an opportunity to share in the magnificent benevolence of his gratuitous love for all of us. And he says, Father, when's the last time you wrote every one of those human sentiments down in your own penmanship to Father Jerry Cousinota, who locked me up? Express every one of those desires, plus the fact that you wouldn't be given the opportunity to live, you wouldn't be given the opportunity to function or do anything which you've been called to do. You wouldn't be able to live to those things, to anything, that you'd be dead by 35. When's the last time you wrote every one of those human emotions down in paper, gone upstairs, taken your pen, in your own penmanship, addressed the letter, come down, get a stamp, lick the stamp, put it on the envelope, and then walk it to the mailbox. When you've done that, come back and we'll talk about gratitude. Naturally, I did it pretty quickly. But that's what it's at. Well, it's not a matter of saying, oh, how happy I am. No? And so we were trained there like every day, you know, for the whole time, you had to do something out of gratitude. For the fact that you are being given a day to breathe, to live, and an opportunity for the future. And that meant intentionality, you know, which means doing, and it doesn't, and it cannot be announced to anybody. You know, you're not doing it for brownie points. And at the beginning, it had to be turned in, but only to Mr. Ripley. But what it is that we're beginning to appreciate, you know, again, count our blessings, appreciate what's going on. You know, we have to say, you know, how do we express gratitude to people? You know? Are we able to tell people we love them? I'll never forget, I did a mafia marriage in Detroit, right? Highly connected, this big time stuff. And I said, well, okay, this is a sacrament. When in our church, what a sacrament is Christ in fleshing himself in our presence, pitching his tent among us, for all of us to have an opportunity to recommit ourselves in our commitments of love. Myself as a celibate priest, yes, and for everybody that we are called together by this beautiful bride and groom, you know, to witness in front of a faith-filled community an opportunity for all of us to grow and recommit ourselves in love. So I want all you husbands to turn to your wives and say, I love you. Well, I almost got shot. Father, what the hell's going on? I've lived with him for 25 years. What am I going to be saying that for? I mean, big time, right? I never did it again in that type of a marriage. But she knows that I'm still here, huh? Right? No. And so I just, and then to be able to accept it back. So what gratitude is the action, right? And every day is a daily reprieve. Every day is a sheer gift. But you know, by rights, we all should be either dead or in the nut house. Dead, well, I mean, dire Indiana. If you saw the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, it was just like that. You know, and my dream now is if I could find the 38 of the most greatest people in the world, I'd like to go back and experience it all over again because we had a ball, right? You laughed, you were crying when it was going on, but to look at it now, it was really a growth experience. You don't know how you ever got through it. And it prepared me for what was to happen for the next 20 years, too. However, so that's the gratitude of it. But every one of us are called, and you know, we can't go by a day and should not without doing something. Just out of gratitude. It can be a smile, it can be a thought, it can be a kind word, it can be appreciation, it can be just something. But you're making the intentionality that higher power, God, creator, spirit, great spirit, whatever being, whatever it is giving us an opportunity, you know, to do these things. And it certainly is done in consideration of other people, and that means getting out of ourselves. Because the world was not created for Vaughn Quinn. The sun does not get up and come out every day, even though sometimes it can be behind clouds for me. As an alcoholic, we really believe that and try to imprint on other people that they should be gracious for the fact that we're here. And you learn about these things. You know, I learned about it because they used to take us to the head shrink twice a week, and intentionally they'd leave you stand there for an hour in the corner. And then when you got in the chauffeur-driven car, you most probably had some words to say, right? And 10 weeks later, Mr. Ripley would say, are you grateful? Oh, yes. Well, listen what you said. His Majesty the baby was kept waiting for 45 minutes, right? Father, the world is not made for you. But you are made to serve the world and you're called to serve. And in the fellowship of AA, Al-Anon, it's exactly that. You know, in whatever way that we are supposed to extend ourselves for the good of other people, it's done in many, many ways. You know, certainly in the 12 steps. Now, the 12th step is spiritual awakening, which again is the culmination or end of all of the other steps. Right? Then when we get that, You know, and it doesn't mean we're going to get it locked in a test tube and it's never going to change. But when we're grooving on that, then we're able to go to other people and share our experience. You are not going to get the person. Your primary reason for going, hopefully, yeah, is to bring about, but you're not there to get anybody sober. You're there for yourself. Right? And that's the important thing. And when you get yourself out of the picture and are able to explain some of these things and just telling your story very honestly, then that the seed will be planted and some great effect will take place. Maybe not right now. Look at Bill Wilson. You know, 6 months, not one. And he and Dr. Bob went back later and started checking on all the people, you know, years later, and a percentage of them had gotten into the program. So that's the story. What I've tried to do is kind of prick your conscience, you know, and say, hey, we just can't be in complacency. I was not trying to do it like, if you don't do this, you know, no. But it's just that there's so much more out there, and there's so much more of living out there, and there's so much more to enjoy, and there's so much more to get enthusiastic about and get turned on about, and really, you know, share the contagiousness of joy, you know, and enthusiasm, rather than, you know, for me, I'm just getting through another day. So, you know, it is true that, we're hurting, but I've done a lot of things with pain. I hate love pain, right? Just glory in it. You know, I'm a goaltender who doesn't wear a mask, so you can imagine. Love it. Just love it, boy. And if there's blood, to spill blood for the holy cause of hockey, oh my God, that's great, you know? We're the type of idiots that run down football fields with our kneecaps torn off for the glory of football, screaming. It's insane, all right? So, okay. I appreciate the concern and the listening you've done and the participation and the being here. And I just pray. And that's what I did at 5 o'clock, went to Mass and prayed for you. Because I'm not here to put a show on, you know, and I know I'm good at that if I want to be, right? And if you want entertainment, that's my other role. We can do it. But that's the public persona, and that's not what we're here. I said at the beginning, this is very sacred. It's very sacred because you're beautiful, beautiful people, and you've got to be able to come in contact with that. And if you can't come in contact with the first love and your own beauty, then you don't have anything to share with people. And then life kind of loses its meaning. Love is the only thing that gives life meaning, right? And sure, we got all caught up in many different ways of trying to express that. And this program teaches us many, many different ways. So I'm going to just stop now with a poem that I think I stole it from Joe Martin. And I went to Joe Martin. I asked him, Joe, where'd it come from? And he says, I don't know. I stole it from somebody, too. And it's an anonymous thing, right? I do not wish you joy without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the cooling shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith, hope, love, strength, wisdom, goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you blessed song and God's sweet peace when every day is done. God bless you.